What in God's name do you need to solve it for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
G'day, Mark. How are you?
Good, thanks, Brent. I don't know what happened with the telephone, but we've moved offices here on the 11th floor of Parliament House, so technology, it's never easy, is it?
No. So how many, when you say the 11th floor, how many floors are there in Parliament House? I didn't realise there were 11 floors there to move to.
There's 12.
12
and
floors?
Five of them have got MP offices. The parliaments themselves, the two chambers, are on the 7th floor. The library and the cafe and a few other things are on the 6th floor. And then underneath is parking. Car parking.
Right. You'd get a good view from your office, do you?
Yeah, I suppose if I twist my neck enough, I can see a portion of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. How about that?
That's pretty nice. I remember years ago, in a different life, I worked for Westfield, and the general manager was a great bloke. He was the general manager of the shopping centre section, and he had an office on Westfield Towers is 24 or 25 stories high, and he had his office on the 23rd or the 24th floor, and he had an office on the corner, and then you walked into a small boardroom, and it was all glass. And I remember being in his office, and you had this most magnificent view, because he looked straight down over the water, the Harbour Bridge, the Opera House. My goodness me, I said to him one day, how do you ever get any work done here? And he said, believe it or not, I've been in the office so many years now, you sort of take it for granted.
Yeah, well, my desk faces the other way, so I don't look out. So it's obligatory to get some work done. Was that in the Westfield Towers in William Street?
It was, yeah.
I worked on the 19th floor for many years as a research assistant to Gough Whitlam.
Did you really?
How about that? Yeah, wow. Small world. We were probably in the lift together.
God, I remember those were the days, and those were the days when you went to management meetings, the lowies turned up. They were there, all three of them. Yeah, they were at the end of the board table. They were hands on, particularly Frank Lowy. I mean, he was hands on, and so was David, and so was Stephen. Yeah.
They were indeed. I think that most of their investments now are in the United States. So
yes, they are.
You don't read much about the Lowy family, but they were hands-on. They came out, for instance, for negotiations to buy a road to expand their shopping centre at Liverpool when I was on the council there.
Okay.
So they were all over it, very hands-on.
Yeah. It's a great story, the Lowy story. All right, let's talk to you about Chris Minns, and he's facing some pushback within his own ranks on this plan to increase housing density across Sydney. Backbenchers have spoken out about government-enforced zoning changes in closed-door caucus meetings. It's on for young and old. I don't know. Do you see a light at the end of this tunnel for Chris Minns?
Well, there's a bit of a stoush, but we've got to admit that the local government authorities in Sydney in particular have had it pretty soft and easy for decades, really. They had housing targets under the former government, but they were voluntary. If you didn't meet the target, it was a bit like climate change targets. If you don't meet the target, no one did anything about it. It's like, oh, okay, you didn't meet your target. So the councils on the North Shore in particular did nothing in terms of housing supply. There's some incredible data that over 5 years, Mossman Council increased their housing stock by 30 in 5 years. I mean, it's just laughable. So the North Shore councils have done nothing in terms of housing supply, which of course adds to affordability. Minns has only got one issue he's pushing hard on, and that's to increase housing supply. It's a long lag. It was, you know, there's some data out from planning and Treasury saying that within 5 years they'll only produce 9% of the housing target that the state government has set. But you've got to start somewhere, and you've got to say to these local government authorities, Sydney's got to go up. We're a very flat city. If you want to have young people with affordable housing, we need more apartments, and they've got to pull their weight. Some Labor-controlled councils at Canterbury, Bankstown and the Inner West have arced up about it, but they too have got to pull their weight. And I think at the end of the day, Minns has got to say, well, look, you know, local government is under a state government legislation, and if you don't pull your weight, you'll lose your planning powers and we'll do it for you. So, you know, I think the stoush has become a bit more ferocious yet to come.
Can I ask you, Mark, I mean, we've talked a fair bit in the last couple of weeks about immigration numbers, and I think it was also talked about on TV the other night, maybe on Sky News with Dick Smith, because we know that Dick Smith thinks that, you know, immigration numbers should be topped at around about 75, 76,000 each and every year. What's your thoughts on the housing situation? I mean, we can't house the people that we've got, the population that we now have in this country. Let's talk New South Wales, because primarily a large percentage of these immigrants end up living in New South Wales. I mean, we can't find homes now for the population of New South Wales as it is without adding an extra, you know, 250,000 next year and the year after that and the year after that. There really is a major, major problem with the lack of housing, and it seems as though it's the lack of planning as well, Mark.
Yeah, you're spot on. Most migrants move to where they've got relatives or familiar communities, which is Western Sydney in particular. So if you have a big immigration program, you bring more people into Sydney, we haven't got enough housing already, you add to the housing affordability crisis. So we need that sensible pause on migration numbers. Dick Smith is right. We should stabilise the numbers so Australia's population is stabilised, and that's a big benefit to Sydney. The other immediate thing you can do is get rid of all the green tape and environmental costs on housing. The Housing Task Force has estimated that it's up to $100,000 extra cost for standalone housing because of green tape, BASICs and environmental levies and tree preservation orders and so forth, all the probably dozens of environmental requirements now to build a new home, and $40,000 for an apartment. So if you want to knock $100,000 off the cost of a new home and $40,000 off the cost of a new apartment, get rid of all the green tape. So there are things that Chris Minns could do, much more immediate and practical, to lower housing costs, and something the federal government can do, and that's to stabilise the immigration numbers. Those two are immediate and urgent, whereas the housing supply task, of course, is medium and long term, because it just takes, you know, a long while to get the zoning, the development applications, and people to get the finance to actually get their new home.
You're a great numbers man. Answer this question, because we keep being told by politicians, and for that matter by some economists, some numbers people, that immigration is really important to our bottom line in this country. How true is that? I mean, how true is it that the politicians look at the better off their budget will be is determined upon, you know, the number of people that we welcome into the country each year?
Well, there's a couple of things, but they're both kind of a sugar hit. Migrants bring extra money into the country, you know, they bring their bank account effectively and some assets, particularly if they're skilled migrants that have got a successful working career or going to set up a business. So they add to the nation's wealth as soon as they jump off the plane. But if you've got a housing affordability crisis, that sugar hit is not much use to you because you've got a much bigger problem that you need to fix. And the other thing is, with an ageing population, if you bring younger migrants in, again skilled, who can fill gaps in the labour force, then that's got some efficiency benefits, but they're marginal and long-term, really, with regards to the demographics. So I think if you've got a housing affordability crisis, it's common sense to say we need a migration pause so we can house the people that we need to in Sydney, and young people, well, you know, grew up here, get a chance to get their foot in the door, literally. That's a much bigger priority than the sugar hit from short-term immigration.
Anthony Albanese, believe it or not, has urged voters to trust him. Yes, he has said, trust me, as he's dodged questions well over and over again, whether he's opening to break, I suppose, his promise not to touch negative gearing or investment properties. After what happened with Stage 3 tax cuts, I don't think too many people believe it when politicians stand up and say, no, we're not going to touch that. Even though, is it fair to say, they lost the 2019 election, which was looked upon by Labor as the unlosable election. They lost that based on, you know, policies to do with negative gearing.
They did indeed, and they were the policies that Labor truly believes in. Chris Bowen, as the Shadow Treasurer, drafted policies to knock off the franking credits and also the parts of the capital gains tax and negative gearing. So there were big, big Labor promises there to knock off tax benefits that a lot of middle-income Australians rely on, a lot of retirees rely on. So that's what Labor really believes in, and that's the risk, isn't it? Albanese, in his heart of hearts, believed in changing the Stage 3 tax cuts, but put his hand on the Bible and said, oh, no, you can trust me, I'd never do that. And he said that 100 times. Well, if he breaks that promise, maybe he's going to break the others. So I don't think there's any guarantees anymore. If the Prime Minister's not someone who can be trusted to stand by his word and his promises, then no one will trust him in these other areas. And certainly if you vote Labor at the next election, you'd be thinking they'll go back to that Chris Bowen, Bill Shorten tax agenda to fiddle around detrimentally with the franking credits, the negative gearing and the capital gains tax.
How honest do you think they'll be if an intention is to take this to the next election in reference to voicing this and putting it up front for everyone to know exactly what their intentions are, because they realise they lost an election because of it once before? How silly can they be to revisit these policies?
Well, they weren't up front against the stage three tax cuts. It's thought that if they told us the truth of breaking that commitment, they would have lost the last election. So they're not in the business of losing elections, but you might find if they're re-elected, they'll go back to that Chris Bowen agenda from 2019, and they've got a very left-wing, sympathetic Senate with the Greens and Senator Pocock and others there who'll support the so-called left-wing tax changes. So it wouldn't be that hard to get it through the Parliament within 12 months of the next election, and then maybe they think, oh, well, we didn't promise that, but everyone will forget it 2 years later when they have the next general election. That's, unfortunately, the cycle of broken promises that Labor's entered into. They're the bells, Brent, for the resumption of Parliament in 15 minutes after the lunch break. So maybe a good time for us to have a break.
You took the words right out of my mouth. We're talking to Mark Latham this afternoon. Each and every Thursday, we catch up with Mark. Mark, workers can now take their bosses to the Fair Work Commission to stop being harassed after hours, and employers can even incur fines or criminal sanctions if they continue to make unreasonable contact. This is under new IR laws that have been locked in by Labor and the Greens.
Well, I think this is over the top. There's three aspects of the new laws, and the first two aren't too bad. There's a chance for casuals to convert to permanent employment. That's been tested in industries like mining, where not a lot of people do it. You know, a lot of people like being the casual because it gives you flexibility and more money in your pocket up front. And the second provision is greater protection of the gig economy workers. These are the, you know, temporary workers in the IT sector and whizzing around with food deliveries and so forth. So I think that's fair enough. But this provision of unreasonable contact with workers, you know, it'll lead to a lot of extra costs for business, because if a worker takes you to the tribunal, if you rang them up in the middle of dinner, or you rang them up when they were, changing the baby's nappy or something, it was inconvenient, well, it might have been an emergency for the business. And they might say, oh, that's reasonable. But it'll be tested through the tribunals. A lot of businesses will have to fork out extra money as workers test this new right. So I just don't think this was necessary. Do we know of a big bunch of people who complain that, oh, my boss rang me up out of hours because there was an urgent thing? Like, part of working for a company in particular is teamwork, that you're all committed to the company being profitable and surviving. That's how you keep your job and put food on the table. So I don't think this has been unreasonable in Australia. I don't think it's been a big problem. It looks like it's a trade union demand that Labor's just caved into, and the Senate is ticking off as we speak.
I see that Adam Band has said today, when you clock off, you'll be able to switch off, thanks to the Greens, after a long push to protect people's time at home and their time with their families. Adam Band, caring for you now and forever.
Well, he's permanently switched off with that sort of attitude. It's just not the way the private sector operates. There's lots of things that happen out of hours that need attention, and I don't think bosses by and large in Australia are unreasonable and saying, you know, can a worker help out? And maybe they pay overtime for it when it happens, depending on the commitment. So I don't think this dramatic separation of work and personal time is practical in the modern economy, where, quite frankly, the modern economy is much more 24/7 than it used to be.
Sure.
Businesses are expected to go around the clock, and workers to enjoy the benefits of overtime and extra money and a profitable business. That may well be a nuisance, but I think most workers think, well, you know, if there's something urgent that happens at the business out of hours, yeah, I've got to put my shoulders to the wheel and be part of the team effort to get it fixed.
The namby-pamby rule. The namby-pamby IR rule for namby-pambies. Nemesis. Nemesis. It's the ABC show. I've got to be honest, I haven't watched it. I've read a little bit about it, but I haven't watched it. But You say it's a bad look for ScoMo.
Yeah, well, it's one of those shows, a retrospective on the Abbott, Turnbull and Morrison governments.
Right.
And for political junkies, they're all very addictive, these shows, because people that you've long forgotten, like Warren Ench and Craig Launder, get out there and give you the ins and outs of who said what at the dinner that triggered a leadership challenge and so forth. So it's all quite intriguing. But the star of the show, for all the wrong reasons, is Scott Morrison, who's sitting there on the program being interviewed, consistently saying he knew absolutely nothing about the Malcolm Turnbull plot to get rid of Tony Abbott, even though Turnbull and his associates are saying, oh, yeah, we kept ScoMo on the loop and ScoMo was going to be my treasurer and he was voting for us and so on. So they've really outed Morrison as duplicitous, and it's a bad look. He just looks like a professional liar. Why he participated in an ABC hit job on the Liberal Party, I don't know. Tony Abbott and Peter Credlin and Julie Bishop all said, no, we don't want to be interviewed. And I think in hindsight, Scott Morrison would be thinking the same. I know he's leaving the Parliament, but boy, he's going out looking like a real someone who's really loose with the truth.
Maybe it's called notoriety deprivation.
Yeah, maybe, but the next program on Monday night is about his government, so maybe he thought he needed to be there to defend his government. I don't think that'll work. It'll go on being an ABC hit job, but just on him in particular. So he would have been much better off not participating in the series. The series is dominated by Malcolm Turnbull, who I've got to say, Brent, you know, he's not my cup of tea, Malcolm Turnbull, but the one thing you sit there almost admiring it, he is world-class expert on twisting the knife on people. His insults and way of putting people down is just phenomenal. And he's got a full repertoire of it. You know, he missed his calling in life. He should have been a professional bagger of people at sporting events. You know, he's a work of nature. I tell you what, Turnbull is an amazing character, the like of which we'll never see again. But, you know, all's very self-serving and in Malcolm world, everything he did was perfect.
Yeah, true. Chinese New Year, it's out and about. You say there's more signs in Sydney for Chinese New Year than there were more signs in Sydney for Australia Day. It's true, but it's sad, isn't it?
Yeah, look, Chinese New Year's a great celebration, the Year of the Dragon. Hopefully it brings the St George Rugby League team a bit of luck. The Year of the Dragon, much needed. And it's a celebration that not only the Chinese community but other people join in. But it is a reflection of the times in which we live, that at Sydney Airport, the centre of Sydney, you see many, many more signs and celebrations of Chinese New Year than we did of our own National Day. You know, it's a sad thing when a country loses so much pride in its own achievements and now looks embarrassed to fly the flag, sing the anthem and be proud of what we've achieved over a relatively short period of time. You know, the Australian story is a remarkable one, and I don't begrudge the Chinese their celebration, but boy, we should celebrate ourselves first and foremost.
You talked about working on the 19th floor of Westfield Towers for Gough Whitlam. I was in the Opera House toilets in July. This is going back in the 90s, and Gough Whitlam was in the toilet at the same time as me, and it was the weekend of his birthday. Mm-hmm. And I knew it was his birthday, and I'm standing there, it's just he and I, and I said, good afternoon, Mr. Whitlam, and he said, hello. And I said, happy birthday to you for today. And he looked at me and he said, you'll excuse me if I don't shake your hand.
The 11th of July.
Yeah,
you get different stories of toilet encounters with former prime ministers. I've got a mate of mine who says he saw Bob Hawke in the toilets and Hawke was boasting about the size of his appendage and all that. So, you know, it's a funny environment in which to see someone who's quite famous. That's
it
true.
Is, yeah.
So it's probably a healthy thing he didn't shake your hand, he shook something.
Exactly out. Right, yeah. it made me laugh, and I thought the wit of the man, brilliant. All right, Mark.
He was a very quick-witted individual, there's no doubt. You know, yeah. Very, very clever person. Not fantastic, I suppose, for the reputation of his government, but in many respects, a brilliant individual.
I'll let you go. I'll let you get back to Parliament. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Yeah, I've got a debate in 4 minutes' time down in the chamber, so timing is perfect. Thanks, Brent.
Thanks, Mark. We'll talk to you next week. That's Mark Latham this afternoon, and as you know, we catch up with Mark each and every Thursday.